All right, everybody, we'll go ahead and get started with our next panel. Panel number four. Hope everybody got lots of coffee, tea, lots of hot drinks, because, you know, it's cold in here. We did request to have the air turned down a little bit. So our next panel is The Future of the ADA, Making It Work Better. It's a good topic. And our lead presenter is Samuel Bagenstos, and he's been appointed as the professor of law at the University of Michigan Law School beginning this fall. Currently, he is a visiting professor of law at the UCLA School of Law. Notable cases he has litigated include two Supreme Court cases upholding the constitutionality of the ADA, Tennessee v. Lane and United States v. Georgia. His book, Law and the Contradictions of the Disability Rights Movement, is being published in June by the Yale University Press. Here to lead off this panel is Samuel Bagenstos.
Well, so first of all, I like the institution of applauding before I speak, because you're less likely to do so after I speak. That's what I find. I find the applause is much more readily available before than after I speak. Doesn't work for other speakers. I don't know why. I want to say that I'm just really incredibly honored and pleased to be here, to have been invited to speak at this conference in honor of Jacobus Ten Broeck, who, you know, really is a hero and role model to me. You know, he was the ideal of the engaged academic. He was a professor. He was a professor at the University of California, and he wrote a lot. He wrote a lot about disability rights, creating the modern ideas of disability rights law. Everything we do today comes from Jacobus Ten Broeck in one way or another. We're working out the ideas he had, you know, 40 plus years ago, but also wrote in constitutional law. We heard references earlier this morning. The Tussman and Ten Broeck article on the equal protection of the laws is the article that actually created the structure by through which students learned the 14th Amendment for two generations, right? Since from the 1940s through the 1980s, that was the intellectual structure, and it came from Jacobus Ten Broeck. His work on the anti-slavery origins of the 14th Amendment, also incredibly powerfully important intellectually. The Supreme Court didn't quite get it in the Morrison case, but nonetheless very powerful and important. And his work on poverty law, he was the person who created the legal theories of the successful welfare rights movement in the 1960s, right? To do this as a professor while teaching a full load, while writing, while litigating, amazing, and something that I know that I could never achieve but do aspire to. And as I work on the occasional case, I think, boy, you know, just a couple more landmarks, 10 more landmarks, and I'm up to Jacobus Ten Broeck. So it's a big honor to speak at a conference in honor of Jacobus Ten Broeck. What Jacobus Ten Broeck said in his two famous articles in the California Law Review in the mid-1960s, in 1966, that created the intellectual architecture of disability rights law and disability rights thinking in America, what he said was integration is the answer, right? That's the first heading in one of the articles, integration, the answer. At its best, that's what the ADA does, right? The ADA is a tool for creating integration in America, integration of people with disabilities into the mainstream of American life, to rectifying the failure to take account of people with disabilities in designing institutions, in designing physical structures, in designing social structures. And that was the promise of the ADA. it hasn't fully worked out that way, right? As everyone in this room knows, I don't need to go into the sad litanies, but you've heard many of them. They're tired by now. It's the lack of improvement in employment for people with disabilities, although some classes of people with disabilities, there have been improvements in employment. The lack of indicia of integration, people going out with friends, people visiting other people's houses who have disabilities, right? Not much improvement there. You all know the statistics. I don't need to go into it. In large part, that's because of structural factors that go way beyond anything a civil rights law could possibly address. And so it's not something you could really charge to the ADA, but the ADA could be doing a much better job. We've seen recent legislative efforts to improve the ADA. I'll talk a little bit about. How could the ADA be doing a much better job? Well, I mean, one could play on Jacobus Tenbroek's idea that integration is the answer, that what is needed is integration of a different kind, integration of the approach to disability rights law across different areas of the law, across different areas of life, and across different government agencies, because in fact, all of the various kinds of exclusion and discrimination against people with disabilities are related to each other, right? If you have lack of access to transportation, then you don't even have to have employment discrimination for people not to be able to get jobs. If you have discrimination in education, right, then you have people who lack qualifications to get better jobs. Again, you don't need discrimination. If you have the Social Security Administration and the EEOC working at cross purposes, right, then you have an impediment to employment, irrespective of what the statutes of what the ADA says. And so one way of thinking about this is, how could we improve integration for people with disabilities in the community of America by improving integration across the various areas of life that disability rights law addresses? And so I want to talk about 10 of them. I have this idea, the conceit came to me. I used to be a fan of David Letterman. Now I'm old and I don't stay up that late anymore. It's a terrible thing to admit. I'm much older than I look. So I nonetheless remembered fondly the top 10 lists of David Letterman. And so I have a top 10 list from my home office, which is the introduction suggested. I have no idea where I live at the moment. I live in at least 3 different cities right now. So my home office, somewhere flying above Nebraska on American Airlines, top 10 ways that enforcement of the ADA could be improved, because we have ways that the effectiveness of the ADA can be improved. We have an incredible opportunity right now. We have revisions to the statute, to the ADA, adopted last year. Kareem Dale suggested this morning that maybe people jumped the gun, maybe people did something too quick and therefore got less than they could. I don't know. I think the politics are very complicated. I think it was hard enough to get that law through, which has all kinds of limitations, but there are real opportunities to it too. We also have a new administration, an administration that is clearly committed in very substantial ways to civil rights and disability rights in particular, with representation in the administration of a lot of people who get it in terms of disability rights. And so what are the top 10 things that could be done, that should be done? I'll roughly group them according to the functional area of life that the law addresses, but most of these are cross-cutting in one way or another because it's all related. So number one, I won't do the conceit of going from 10 to 1 because that never worked for me. Number one, the first order of business, right, for the new administration, for people in this new world thinking about the ADA, is aggressive efforts to shape the way the open questions in the new ADA Amendments Act are going to be resolved. There are a number of open questions, right? So the ADA Amendments Act was essentially the compromise proposal that emerged, as you all probably know, that emerged after the initial efforts at an ADA Restoration Act weren't going to go anywhere in Congress, at least at the time. An ADA Restoration Act, the effort was to return to the original proposal in 1988, the original proposal drafted by Bob Bergdorf, who spoke here last year about this topic, and introduced in Congress by Lowell Weicker and Tony Coelho, the original proposal of the ADA, which would have said disability means a present, past, or perceived impairment, physical or mental, no substantial limitation of major life activities, right? Many people concluded after the Supreme Court's decisions in Sutton and then in Toyota versus Williams, an especially egregious case, that the fundamental error of the original ADA was in including this limited, narrow, protected class of people with disabilities, right? And that it's clear when you read Toyota, when you read Justice O'Connor's opinion for the court, which is a unanimous opinion for the court in Toyota versus Williams, right, where she says the definition of disability needs to be strictly construed to create a demanding standard for qualifying as disabled, right, that she took the idea of protected class as essential to the ADA. What a lot of people said, and I think there's very much to this, and buy my book, and you can see what I say about this, which is just going to tease it. Buy my book. So what a lot of people said, and there's a lot to this, is that that mentality, the protected class mentality, right, was reminiscent of people's ideas of disability as we heard at lunchtime, as a need, as something that we provide for, that something we compensate for, right, as something we provide charities, welfare for. And ever since the Elizabethan poor laws in Anglo-American society, when we give people welfare, we're very worried that we're only giving it to the really needy and deserving, which means we narrow and narrow and narrow the class. And so the proposal from many people in the disability community was return to the original 1988 language. And that was a proposal that had a lot of power behind it in the disability community, but in the end is not what emerged from Congress. So what emerged from Congress was a much narrower overturning of the Supreme Court's negative decisions. So what there are four essential open questions left. First of all, the other thing I should say is there were proposals in the disability community to overturn a lot of other decisions that the Supreme Court have made that had narrowly construed the disability rights laws, including the Buchanan decision, which I think if you have one thing, and that's one of the things I'll say, if you have one thing that should be overturned, it's that's the most significant limitation on disability rights litigation. But eventually what emerged was a much more targeted bill aimed at the definition of disability. The four open questions resolved are these. One is the question of mitigating measures, right? The Sutton-Murphy cases say that if a person has an impairment that substantially limits major life activities before using medication or a prosthetic or something else, then it doesn't matter if once they use the medicine, prosthetic, or something else, they no longer have a substantial limitation. Congress directly overturned that pretty clearly, with an exception for eyeglasses, right, which was the subject of the Sutton case. Gerard Quinn was talking about strategic litigation. I think the Sutton case was not an example of strategic litigation, having the first disability case in the Supreme Court be twin sisters who have 20/20 vision when they wear their eyeglasses, but not when they don't. And there's an exception in the bill for eyeglasses, with an exception to the exception that seems to take the exception entirely away. So it's very confusing. The law is actually very confusing to read. But basically, the Sutton case seems to be overturned in its entirety. We ignore mitigating measures now in their entirety. Secondly, the statute includes, and this is an area where there is substantial room for efforts by the EEOC to give content through regulations and through litigants in courts to give content through litigation. Secondly, the Congress changed the definition of major life activities, said major life activities include major bodily functions. Now, at a theoretical level, this is actually a difficult provision to swallow in some ways. It moves toward a much more medicalized understanding of what disability is, something that Congress had tried to move away from. So now anything that substantially limits a major bodily function, which is some internal bodily function that doesn't necessarily have effects on the outside, have effects in interacting with society or the world, is a disability. That's a medicalized understanding, but it broadens the understanding of disability. One question is how much? How much does it broaden the understanding of disability? And that is really something that is yet to be determined. Courts could read it very narrowly or could read it very broadly. The EEOC will have a lot to say in its regulations. The statute gave the EEOC clear authority to issue regulations defining disability for the first time, overturning that aspect of Sutton, but could be read narrowly, could be read broadly. Secondly, the second open question, the third issue that Congress resolved, substantial limitation. What is a substantial limitation? Well, Remember, the original proposal was get rid of the idea of substantial limitation entirely. They couldn't quite do that. The bill that emerged out of the House said substantial limitation means, or the bill that emerged out of the House said substantial limitation means materially restricts. What's materially restricts? Well, that was very complicated. That was a nice phrasing, I always thought, because material in law tends to mean, you know, something is meaningful, but it doesn't have to be that significant, right? If you look at cases where people are put in jail for material misrepresentation of things, for fraud, right? It doesn't have to be that important. But nonetheless, people didn't like that. And so eventually what Congress did is totally punt it on the question of what substantial limitation means. Substantial limitation means, well, what we intend it to mean. That's actually what they said, without saying what. So substantial limitation shall be interpreted consistently with the findings and purposes of this statute. Okay, what did the findings and purposes of the statute say? Well, they said that the court in Toyota got it wrong, erected a too demanding standard, so we know it's less demanding than Toyota. And we know that they also say that the EEOC erected too demanding a standard by saying substantially limits means significantly restricts. I mean, in defense of the EEOC's original regulation, substantial and significant are pretty much synonyms. Limit and restrict are pretty much synonyms. So it's hard to say they got it terribly wrong, but the way that had been interpreted was very much narrowing the definition of disability, narrowing the scope of protection. And Congress says not as high as that. Obviously, there's an enormous amount of leeway. There's an enormous amount of space between the very tight constraints that the court imposed in the Toyota case and nothing, right? And what is substantial limitation? That's going to be up to the EEOC in the first instance. I hope we hear Commissioner Griffin say something about what the EEOC might do, but at the very least, the EEOC has to be thinking about that. Okay. The fourth change, and this is also very much open, is the expansion in the statute of the regarded as prong, the perceived disability prong of the disability definition. Now, I've argued that the perceived disability prong is really the centerpiece of the statute, at least was the centerpiece of the original statute, which the whole effort was to change the understanding of disability from something that's medical, from something that's a physical limitation, to something that arises out of an interaction between a person's characteristics and society's attitudes and structures, right, and which comes directly from Jacobus Tenbrook. What the courts had done, though, led by the Sutton case, was really narrow the regarded as prong of the disability definition so that it didn't mean very much at all. What Congress did is significantly expand the regarded as prong so that it looks like any time an employer discriminates against an individual because of that individual's impairment, substantially limiting or not, that individual is, by that act, regarded as having a disability. It's a confusing provision of the statute. And I think it was ended up written in a confusing way because it was the result of negotiations between the disability community and the business community. But this could be very significant. However, it is for the first time limited. Regarded as claims are for the first time limited to express intentional discrimination claims as opposed to accommodation claims. So the only way to get an accommodation is if you have a present disability or maybe a past disability, but not a perceived disability. Again, kind of a medicalizing of the statute. How that's interpreted in the courts will be very significant. So the first big point, and I think the most significant thing about the future of the ADA is we stand here right now, you know, in this part of 2009, is what's going to happen with the new statutory provisions. But I still have nine left, and so let me talk about the other ones somewhat more quickly. Secondly, I have a couple that deal with just specifically with employment cases. Employment's very important. Employment's the area where the ADA has, in some measures, had the least effect, and it was the area where, in some measures, people thought it was most important. Employment, how can we improve the employment rate for people with disabilities by enforcing the ADA better, by doing more under the ADA? Well, one thing we can do, and this is my second point, is expanded focus by the EEOC, particularly because they're the only ones with the resources to do it, on hiring discrimination. Okay? It is a long-standing trend in civil rights law and employment discrimination law in America that the people who can get the people who can get lawyers to represent them in employment discrimination cases are individuals who are incumbent employees who lose their jobs after a number of years on the job. You can kind of understand why, right? One reason is because they actually have money to pay a retainer for a lawyer, even if the lawyer is paid by contingent fee, they want a retainer. The other reason is their damages are significant. They're losing a job, which they've been in for a while, so they have a significant amount of loss. Right? And for a third reason, it's much easier to prove discrimination by an incumbent employee, right? If it's intentional discrimination, right, you can say, well, I got good performance reviews right up until this point. The only difference between me and the people who didn't lose their jobs was some protected classification. If it's reasonable accommodation, you have a whole record of evidence of interactions between you and the employer and what happened and the accommodations that were requested and denied. Much harder to prove hiring discrimination. That's true everywhere in employment discrimination law, and I think it's recognized as the basic problem for the enforcement of employment discrimination law. But in the disability context, way more significant. Why? In the race context, well, if you have a big enough employer, you can always prove discrimination with statistics, right? If there's a big enough employer, they make enough entry-level hiring decisions, then you'll have a body of statistics. You can look at the people in the community who have qualifications that are relevant for the job, what's their racial composition. If there's a substantial difference, right, well, then in the outcomes, then you can say probably discrimination there. You can do that in the case of sex. Disability, there's so many different disabilities, right, each of which has such a small group who might potentially apply to a particular employer, there's no way statistically to develop any inferences, at least most of the time. So it's very difficult to prove hiring cases, and it's generally difficult to prove hiring cases because, you haven't been working on the job. There are lots of other qualified people. I mean, it's usually pretty hard to distinguish among people. So what's the answer? Well, the EEOC has lots more expertise. Not necessarily lots more expertise, has a lot of expertise, has lots more resources, particularly now. And the EEOC could potentially use those resources to adopt an employment testing program, either by financing organizations in states that are doing it or by doing it themselves. There's some legal hoops they might have to jump for the latter. But to essentially send out people, this is the testing program that's been done so effectively in fair housing enforcement, to send out people who are otherwise identical, one with a disability, one without, and have them apply for similar jobs and see whether there's a difference in treatment. In the fair housing context, the U.S. Department of Justice has done this since the late 80s, early 90s, with tremendously good results. Private fair housing organizations do this all the time, right? I mean, that's actually a significant part of what they do. And it could be used in the employment context, and I think is essential to do. I know there have been some steps in that direction. When Evan Kemp, as head of the EEOC, tried to adopt a full-scale employment testing program in 1990, there was substantial negative reaction in Congress, and he eventually dropped it. But there's still a possibility for doing more here, and I think it would be really useful. A second thing about employment, my number three on the list, right? More interaction between the Social Security Administration and the EEOC with respect to individuals who are applying for Social Security disability benefits but who might have experienced discrimination, right? This is pretty easy to understand. There's a whole group of people who are, essentially you make a choice in our system, well, welfare or rights, and what we ought to be doing is taking the people who are applying for welfare and saying, do you have rights that are violated? Can you enforce those? And so I think that's an essential thing to do. I'll go a little quicker since I've taken a long time with those. Number four, public accommodations. The public accommodations title of the ADA is incredibly under-enforced, which I don't have to tell the people in this room, right? I know you go into any block in any city in America and you will find 5 out of every 10 stores are violating Title III of the ADA, right? And why is that? Well, as we heard Amy Robertson say, it's really, really hard to enforce Title III of the ADA and get paid attorney's fees, right? Which means that you have the lawyers like Tim and Amy who are doing this because that's what they really want to do. But, the marginal lawyer has something better to do than bring a lot of cases where they're going to get everything they want and not get paid. Right, I mean that's not going to happen much. Here there's a substantial role for the U.S. Department of Justice, which enforces Title III of the ADA. They've done great work over the past few years in enforcing the ADA against cities, municipalities, enforcing Title II of the ADA against inaccessible public facilities. They could do something like that. What they do is they just go into a city and and detail everything that's inaccessible. They could do that in the context of private facilities, too. They could also much more effectively use the U.S. Attorney's offices when, in Democratic administrations, people who work in U.S. Attorney's offices always say they want to do civil rights work, and this would be civil rights work they could easily do. Not actually that complicated to do, doesn't require, like, incredible rocket scientist thinking, just requires people to go out and bring 20 cases, right, and then bring 20 more. And that's and there are just lots of lawyers around the United States working for the Department of Justice who could do that. Number five, a second thing about public accommodations, right, is that it's essential at this point to push on the application of the public accommodations title of the ADA to electronic communication, to the internet, to all that stuff. There have been efforts that it's very tricky legally to apply the public accommodations title of the ADA to the internet because it says place of public accommodation, unfortunately, in the ADA. And people say, well, a place, it's got to be a place. Although Judge Posner, not one who likes the expansive ADA very much, actually said, well, it could be in cyberspace too, and people can run with that. But that's so central to our economy, so much more than it was in the past, and there's so many problems. It's something that the Department of Justice could take a real leadership position in. Okay, number six, and something that requires new legislation, is overturn Buchanan. Right? What's keeping the ADA from being enforced in the public accommodations title? We heard it from Amy. It's Buchanan. Overturn that. That's something that would require legislation, but would be really the most useful thing that could be done legislatively for the ADA. Number seven, added enforcement of the ADA in the area of professional testing, right? It's the professional testing organizations that, again, I don't have to tell this group, I work in a profession. I mean, I work as a gatekeeper for a profession, and the organization that's the gatekeeper for my students, we all know, has incredible difficulty in responding at all appropriately to accommodations requests, right? And what is this about? I mean, part of this is about the professional understanding of the people who do testing, that, well, what I'm about is finding a test that works for the standard person, right? It's a standardized test. The only way it can ever be valid and reliable is if we make no changes for anyone. Totally contrary to the theory of disability rights law, they don't get it. And one reason, and you know, previous departments of justice have tried to bring cases like this, or at least push them along. Obviously, there are plaintiffs bringing cases against the LSAC, the people who do the MCAT, et cetera. But I think that's an area where there's such widespread discrimination, it's incredibly important to really push. Okay. So 8, 9, and 10 are three things about Olmstead. The Brown versus Board of Education of the Disability Rights Movement in 1999, the integration mandate, ADA requires some sort of deinstitutionalization. Okay. Number eight. Olmstead principles should be front and center in any discussion within the Obama administration or within Congress about healthcare reform. Right? Healthcare reform is going to have an enormous effect on people with disabilities. It's going to, the terms of healthcare reform are going to determine whether people with disabilities are going to be able to live in the community or are going to be forced to continue to live in institutional settings, are going to determine whether people with disabilities can benefit from healthcare reform while working or not. Right? We know all about the skews and the problems in current Medicare, Medicaid law, and healthcare reform could make them much better or make them much worse. Right, that has to be central. The Olmstead idea of integration has to be central to any discussion of healthcare reform. Secondly, let's just make it top nine because I've been going on too long and Chris needs to talk. So secondly and last. No, it's fine. No, I want to hear from you. And I've packed so many words in here, I really want to hear from you. So you want to go to 10? Okay, we'll go to 10. That's fine. Okay, so secondly, Olmstead in general. Olmstead, an incredibly important decision, big flurry of activity in the states afterwards, partly because of how Justice Ginsburg framed the opinion, right? She said, well, first off, there's a requirement to integrate, there's a requirement to move people out of institutionalized settings if the state's professionals think that it's okay, right? So there's this reliance on state's professionals, which is deeply problematic. But state's professionals will often say it's okay, as you know. But then the second thing she said is, but the state has a defense if they have a plan to move people equitably through the waiting list. And, you know, this is, I think in some ways her response to what, you know, she's a New Yorker, right? She lived in New York until 1980 when she was appointed to the D.C. Circuit. And New York in the 1970s was, at least to many people, right, an example of deinstitutionalization without doing anything for people once they're out of the institution, right? And thereby taken by people as, I mean, by, you know, scratch any New York liberal from late 1970s, and what are they going to say? Deinstitutionalization, really important but really problematic. I'm not sure we should have done that, right? And this is her effort to avoid that problem. What it did was led states to do a couple of things. I mean, it led states to create a process to move people out of institutions. Good. Also, to wall off people who weren't waiting in the queue to say, well, you can't take advantage of these rights. Bad. But the process was going on and was really picking up momentum. The Bush administration, when it came into office, had these very promising words to say, the New Freedom Initiative, right, the New Freedom Initiative. I always thought of a joke by Yakov Smirnoff about feminine hygiene products in America, but when I heard the New Freedom Initiative, but you may not remember it, but look it up on YouTube. Once it's in your head, you'll never forget it when you hear the New Freedom Initiative. But very promising set of ideas that we're gonna move people out of institutions. There's a lot of convergence between disability rights ideas and some conservative ideas here, right? In deinstitutionalization. Deinstitutionalization itself, right, not generally thought of as a conservative Republican idea, but one thing, it does save money. That's one of the arguments that we're always making about deinstitutionalization. People don't want to spend money on domestic priorities. They say, hey, this is pretty good. We'll cut our budgets. For another thing, it may, this is one of the political problems with getting deinstitutionalization out of a Democratic administration, it may be a way for a bad Republican administration to attack unions, attack the union workers in the public employee unions who are overwhelmingly Democratic, by saying we'll move people to out of institutionalized settings where it'll be harder to organize workers. And that's definitely been something that's been a big discussion, as you all know. But good initial noises. Then we have state budget crises, right, which have effectively stopped a lot of Olmstead. Not entirely, but, you know, for the last couple of years, there's just not much going on. That needs to be restarted. That needs to become a priority. Now, Tom Perez, who is, as we've heard, is going to be probably the new assistant secretary, the new assistant attorney general for civil rights, has substantial experience and a track record in this area, right? He was the person who was head of civil rights at HHS after Olmstead, who organized the response to Olmstead. I know he cares a lot about it, and I hope he does a lot about it too, because it's really essential. It's something that was the central issue for so many people in the disability rights movement. Big victory out of the Supreme Court, and then sort of fizzling and needs to get restarted. Okay, the final thing I have to say. So if you want me to do 10, I'll do 10. The 10th thing is there's been increasing concern about disability rights principles. This isn't so much about the ADA, about disability rights principles and labor and employment law generally. So increasing concern about abuse of the sub-minimum wage programs, right? These are programs that were designed with a totally different understanding of disability than the understanding of disability that emerges out of the ADA and out of the disability rights movement. An understanding of disability as people who are lesser workers and therefore ought to get less for their work. And you see what's happened with some recent incidents is these are often very abusive. These are often people who ought to be who are working and producing as much as anyone else and are just getting paid a lot less, right? And that's something that an administration ought to look at. Abuse of the rehabilitation exception to the National Labor Relations Act, again, emerges out of a model of people, and it's complicated. Not every case is wrong to apply the rehabilitation exception, but you often see people who are essentially doing work that is fully productive as anyone else, and getting compensated less for it and having less rights, right? Which is contrary to the basic principles of the disability rights movement. Now, if those 10 things are done, hey, that's great. And I'm going to be really happy. It probably doesn't solve all the problems. As I say, there are deep structural problems in our society that go way beyond what disability rights laws can do anything about. There are problems of inaccessible transportation, right, that are massive. Our healthcare system, the way it's set up, creates substantial barriers to work and integration for people with disabilities, with changes that might be made better. But if all this is done, it won't solve everything, but it'll make a substantial improvement for people with disabilities and the principles of the disability rights movement. So, thanks.
All right. Well, I wish I had the top 10 to answer all that, but I don't. And I'm going to stick with the employment issues. It's what I do and what I care the most about. And we do want to give you time to actually ask questions. As Sam said in the beginning, integration's the answer. Yes, it is. And for me, integration and employment is all about freedom. You're not free in this country unless you have a paycheck. That's just a fact. And for far too long, people with disabilities have been woefully unemployed, underemployed, whatever term you want to use. We're not getting the jobs, and that's just a reality. And, you know, the ADA, everything, you know, state laws that have been implemented haven't helped, and it's time that we do something about it. My big pet peeve as one of the commissioners at the EOC has been around the area of federal employment, because I think it's where we have the best legal hook. It's where we have the argument that the federal government should be the model employer, and we need to make it the model employer, and then demonstrate to the private sector that it can be done and how it's done. Let me start with the ADA Amendments Act. Yes, we are working on regulations. As a matter of fact, right now, as I speak, there are people back in our Office of Legal Counsel busily, typing, I guess, the regulations that I hope you will all see as soon as we can get them out of the building. There's a process that we go through. I am not at liberty to discuss them at all, which I'm reminded of a lot, since we're very involved in. I have to actually sit sometimes and think, what did the Amendments Act statute say, and what are we talking about with the regs, and separate the two of them? But Sam talked about the open questions, and these are the things that, of course, we will be focusing on. Mitigating measures, it really was fixed. And you know, frankly, I know some people think the gun went off too soon, and maybe people should have waited and done more but in all honesty, what I would say to people as this process was going on and there was the collaboration between the advocacy groups and the business community on coming up with a compromise bill, I said all along, if we fix mitigating measures alone, that will be huge. And I think that's amazing, and I think they were pretty clear. I think the statute, there are some confusing spots where they punted and didn't quite know what to do, but I think overall it was pretty clear. They certainly told us and everybody else what they didn't like about, you know, what we had done at the EEOC and what to change, as well as the Supreme Court cases that they wanted to see overturned. Major bodily functions, I understand people's angst about it being more medical, but frankly, I think it was a reaction to, hey, folks, that's what the judges get. They get the medical part, right? They get the diabetes results it affects this bodily function, and so, you know, it gets, I think, us closer to saying this is a per se disability, whatever that is, whether it's, you know, diabetes or epilepsy. So I think that was amazing. And then substantially limits. Yikes. Really, they did punt because they couldn't agree. That's what it came down to. No one could come up with what is that magic definition that everyone would agree to. So, hey, let's send it back to the EEOC who, oh, by the way, you got it wrong the last time. And here's what you said the last time. Don't say it again, but come up with something else. So that is really, I'll tell you, that is an unbelievable challenge. It really is. And people that have, you know, talked to us about it, we met with the advocacy and the business community negotiation team early on before we actually even started thinking about writing regs and said, let's get a full understanding from them. What did they think this statute actually said? And we heard a variety of things, as you can imagine, and everything from don't define it at all, don't say anything, and say it's more than nothing. And then other people said, oh, no, say that it's, you know, yeah. But there were a variety of definitions, and we're looking at that right now. But that is difficult. But I think what they said clearly is look at the findings and purposes. Define it that way. They said we want this to be very broad. Go back and look at the Rehab Act. Go back and look at what was said in cases under the Rehab Act. And that's, I think, important. And don't say significantly restricts, which I promise you we won't be saying. Regarded as very, very important. I mean, think about what happened with regarded as. There was a compromise made. Okay, if you're asking for a reasonable accommodation, you're out. You're not regarded as. But if you're regarded as, if you have a disability and you're not asking for a reasonable accommodation and you've been discriminated against, you don't have to talk about substantially limits under regarded as. This is huge. So why would you be talking about anything else if your client isn't looking for a reasonable accommodation? And we just have to hope the courts go along with that. Sam talked about hiring. That is the huge issue. Hiring, and the only way of actually proving hiring discrimination is through testing. That's just a fact. And HUD has been doing this for years. The courts have accepted this. There's tons of great cases that accept testing and housing as a viable way of proving discrimination. And we have to do it in employment. That's my personal view. I am not telling you the EEOC and everyone there agrees with me because, frankly, they don't. But I just personally believe that is absolutely true, and I know I have some colleagues that believe it, and I agree. We either have to do it ourselves or we have to give funding to the fair employment practice agencies in this country that we fund or find some vehicle of actually doing employment testing. When I ran the Disability Law Center, the Protection Advocacy Agency in Massachusetts, we did partner with a variety of organizations, and we did housing testing. It's very effective, and it is really the only way of proving hiring discrimination, and we have to do it. The history, you talked about Evan Kemp. Again, in 1996, when Paul Igasaki was the acting chair of the EEOC, he had to make a deal with Newt Gingrich at the time that if they gave him, I forget the number, it was like $10 million more dollars for enforcement, he had to promise not to do testing. Well, there are still people at the EEOC that talk about this and say, oh, no, we promised Newt Gingrich. And I say, Newt Gingrich, long gone. That was a promise for 1 year for $10 million. The promise was made. It was delivered. It was kept. We kept our promise. That was a long time ago. That deal's off the table, and I think that, you know, not that it won't be, you know, objected to, I'm sure, by some people in Congress, but I'm hoping this administration and others in Congress will embrace this idea because we are never going to get to this. We're just never going to break this barrier in the hiring of people with disabilities, the hiring discrimination that goes on until we actually do the testing. Social Security. I too am hopeful that we'll be able to do something there. There's absolutely no reason we can't be collaborating and having a question as someone's applying for Social Security who's currently, you know, who was recently working about whether they experienced discrimination or not. Back when the Equal Pay Act was moved over to the EEOC to enforce, there was a great collaboration between the EEOC, I'm told, and the Department of Labor, wage and hour people. When they went in to do an audit and they saw Equal Pay Act violations, they let us know. It was great, and it worked great. And that over time, that relationship has gone away. There isn't that type of collaboration that goes on for various reasons. And I'm really hoping that we start to see that return. And that's a great idea to work with Social Security. And oh, by the way, for those of you that don't know, Social Security is in the next probably 4 to 6 months hiring 5,000 people. They are committed to hiring, I was told the other day, at least 500 of those people will be people with disabilities. And they are particularly interested in hiring people who are currently beneficiaries and can do the ticket to work program so that they can demonstrate that that can be a success. That would be good. But also that they, more importantly, hire people with disabilities. So I look forward to that happening. I won't even get into my rant and raves about the subminimum wage issue and my experience with that in Massachusetts, where people with psychiatric disabilities were all of the employees except for management in a company that built, a for-profit company that built furniture and sold furniture. I won't go into that. Just know I could do a whole 2 hours on that alone. Future issues I think we're going to have to look at. There are, because we never got to actually litigate employment discrimination under the ADA, because we focused all of our effort on whether you were actually had a disability or not, we are now going to get to that. And that's going to be really interesting. And I'm a little concerned about a couple of things. Direct threat. We're going to start seeing people use direct threat as a defense. And we're going to see some of these same judges say, oh, yeah, wow, that person could fall into that machinery. That's terrible. We can't allow them to do that job. I'm worried about that. And I'm worried about what's going to be reasonable for a reasonable accommodation. We're going to actually start seeing cases, and we're going to start litigating those issues. So I'm a little concerned about those. And hope that we don't see Sutton-like cases go before the Supreme Court to actually determine what happens on those issues. So I think I'll stop there and would love to, if we have time, take questions.
We do have time for questions. I heard Dan Fry over here. Do we have our microphone? Yeah.
Thank you very much. Both of your comments were instructive. We've heard a lot today about a commitment to inclusive behavior, and what I want to say is, by way of comment more than question, I think in principle an inclusive approach is certainly something that is desirable, but I do think there are subtleties to the concept of inclusive practices, particularly in the education arena. And I want to make sure that if those practices are adopted, if they prevail, that attention to the needs of people with disabilities are in fact given. I worry that sometimes you can be in the most inclusive environment and be terribly isolated. So in our zeal to advocate for an inclusive environment, either we need to make sure that it works in the idealistic way that it's thought about, or we need to make sure that there are alternatives out there. Thank you.
Any other questions? Comments?
Put your hands up. Yeah, I think it's just a
okay.
Matter of getting the mic to people.
Let's see. Who has the mic? Oh,
thank you. This is Molly Goslin. Okay. I'm from Florida. And I heard you allude to the Rehabilitation Act, and I was wondering if anywhere in that top 10, somewhere in an outline in ABC, is your focus, or do you see a focus on the reauthorization? Because it's significantly impacting people with cross disabilities in Florida, specifically the Independent Living Program, and nationally. And until we can get the reauthorization through with clarifying language, there's a big possibility that the Department of Education here in D.C., as well as the local state systems, are really dismantling cross-disability programs, especially the independent living programs. Thank you.
Well, that seems very significant, right? and you know, complicated these days. I mean, all the reauthorizations are very complicated, with sort of massive effort to spend a lot of money and now to be very interested in fiscal restraint. And I think it's going to be very complicated, but really important to talk about.
I wish I knew the status of it right now, and maybe you do. I don't. But, you know, yeah, it's clearly very important. There are still, is it? It's stalled right now? Okay. I know the last time I talked to Connie Garner in Kennedy's office about it, but that was a while ago, and as you just mentioned it, I'm sitting here thinking, boy, I don't even know. I know there were concerns about the ILC money and what was going on there, but, yeah.
Bob Dinnerstein, thank you both for your presentations, which are very helpful. One question I have, which I think remains one of the open questions, I guess, is that one of the catch-22s that was a big issue under the ADA, and I don't think has gone away with the amendments, is that back and forth between showing that you're limited enough to come within the definition and yet able to perform the essential functions of the job. And even though the definition of what's substantial will be presumably less than Toyota, as you follow through, it still seems to me that there's going to be a tension there under the amendments. And it still seems to me that there's work to do for those who are out there litigating these cases to work with clients about trying to be or get across better to courts that fine line between, yes, I can do this job, but only if I'm getting the accommodations, which so far they're not providing. Because somehow, as you know, in case after case, the courts in a very kind of literal way say, well, there doesn't seem to be any limitation at all. This person says he can do the job. One can understand the motivation to do that, but it seems to hurt case after case in terms of actual liability.
Well, I think one of the areas where we saw a lot of really horrible decisions was when they actually talk about working as a major life activity. And we said somewhere, I think in guidance or whatever, you know, don't go there. And I would say that 100 times over. I actually joke and say I'd like to designate Peggy Mastriani in our Office of Legal Counsel as the point person. If you even think about arguing working, you have to call her and get her permission. And you walk there. But really, I think that's what hurt us a lot. And it was very confusing, and you know, I'm hoping that, you know, we'll provide some clarity on that. But again, I always say everywhere I speak, you know, if there's any other major, don't throw it in. I think a lot of attorneys just throw everything in, you know, because they feel like they have to plead everything and throw it in there, and you know, throw the kitchen sink in there when you're talking about major life activities. And I would say don't. You know, if you've got a major life activity that you really can hang your hat on, stick with that and leave working only for those, you know, Ms. Williams from the Toyota case who may truly be the only small group of people that really major life activity, the only major life activity that they'll be able to prove is to be covered is working.
I mean, I think the other thing, if I could just say one thing about this, is, you know, what happened in a lot of those cases is you have the plaintiff say in the deposition testimony something very generic.
Yeah.
Well, there's nothing I can't do.
Yeah.
You know, and that was really, I mean, a big tension. It obviously shows that judges don't get it about what this law is about. You know, under the new statute, there are going to be all kinds of ways to establish someone has a disability without having to show limitations, like regarded as, you know, they were discriminated against because they have an impairment. They're pretty much covered. Or this major bodily functions thing, which, you know, there's something going on inside your body that's different, right? And so I think it'll be lessened. I agree it doesn't go away. And part of that is just, you know, the lawyers who bring these cases, right, it's the employment bar that comes out of the Civil Rights Act of 91. They don't necessarily know a lot about ADA cases, even now. And so, you know, in a race discrimination case or a sex discrimination case, you want your client, or an age discrimination case, you want your client to say, I can do everything, right? And so a lot of it was kind of bad preparation of clients.
Tom Berkey, Wellesley College. Very fine presentations. It seemed to me, as the lunch talk suggested, that the root problem here, despite all the legislative and agency fixes, is judges and the inability to get the core concepts of the disability message to judges. And you've talked a little bit about how lawyers maybe could be better at that. Is there, maybe this is a naive question, but is there any ex parte way to educate judges about the disability rights movement, other than the larger culture? Because, you know, other interest groups in society do try to do educational seminars with judges and things like that.
When the ADA was first passed, there was lots of activity and requests to do exactly that. And I was just actually last week, the week before, at the ABA Labor and Employment Conference in Florida. And I was presenting on the Amendments Act with Peggy Mastriani, and we were actually talking to a judge who spoke before us, and we were actually saying to him, he stayed for our session, he said, "Wow, I like this really wasn't on my radar screen. I hadn't even thought about this." We said, "Well, you know what? Actually, we don't think any of you and your colleagues are thinking about this, because there have literally been no requests that anybody knows of to do any training on this at all." Now, that says one or two things, that they just, like him, hadn't really thought about it, didn't focus, didn't know this had happened, or they think, hey, we got it right the first time, what the hell's wrong with all of them, and we'll find a way to shoehorn our old decisions right in with, you know, which is, you know, I mean, we'll see some of that happen. Oh, no, we got it right. Now, we've seen, you know, a couple of cases already where they've said exactly the opposite, where they've actually said, oh, we didn't get it right. You know, the Amendments Act, you know, said, no, this is how we should be looking at this. And so that's a little encouraging. But I'm sure not everyone will be going that way. But I think Peggy and I talked afterwards. I think maybe we need to do something instead of sitting back and waiting for those requests, because maybe they aren't really aware that this change has been made. There's other things on their plate. That maybe we need to be a little more aggressive, saying, hey, we're available to do this training for you. So I think that's what we are going to have to do. We're going to have to say to them, gee, you should take advantage of this.
I think the judges, the problem isn't, for some of them, is they don't get it, lack of consciousness raising. For a lot of them, it's they don't like regulations of businesses, right? And so they're going to be hostile
anyway.
They
don't like employment cases.
They don't, they think they did not become federal judges to have to hear 1,000 employment discrimination cases.
They're really just personality conflicts anyway. That's all they really
want to hear, antitrust cases involving entire industries or whatever it is they want to hear. But no, you hear them talk about employment cases, and they're really hostile to the idea that they have to hear them. And some of these cases, some ADA cases, they feel like this is almost a workers' compensation case. I mean, that's not even judges who do that. Not even state judges. It's just a hearing officer.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that's hard. But I think a lot of the judges in the middle are, you know, they take strong signals. I mean, so when they thought the ADA was really unclear, they read all the lack of clarity against plaintiffs. But, you know, if they think there's a strong signal coming from Congress, I think they'll respond.
Bill Phelan, American Bar Association. My question is for Sam, specifically your number 7, regarding the Law School Admission Council.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you can give some practical X, Y, and Z's that you think LSAC should be doing to make their accommodations process better.
Oh, boy. I mean, you know, you could go on for a long time with that. I think, you know, any professor at any law school any who does disability law and hears from students could go on for a long time about that. I mean, without getting into too many specifics, I think, you know, incredible hurdles to get any kind of accommodations, denials of accommodations where it's really hard to believe that they should be denied, a general hostile attitude toward people who are seeking accommodations.
Because they're all faking, you know.
Right. And that, I mean, the perception is, you know, it's a bunch of people are faking, and, you know, it's just, well, obviously, once we accommodate them, the test doesn't mean anything anyway, and so, and, you know, the answer isn't to try to figure out something better. I think that's a much bigger issue than I could probably go into in a couple of minutes, but you could talk to any of us here, probably.
I think Adrian Ash.
Yeah, Adrian had it.
Trying to, oh, a new toe.
Let's make sure we get Adrian the microphone.
Where's Adrian?
Adrian's right down here.
I really appreciated these talks, but my question has to do with whether direct threat could ruin what regarded as gave us. Because in New York State, the law does not permit a safety to self exception. But obviously the federal, so do we need to get rid of direct threat in order to permit us to have what regarded as gives us? And how are we gonna use the genetic, the inclusion of people with genetic disability or genetically, genetic predispositions to disability to show that this is about disability discrimination and not genetic discrimination?
Mm. Right, so I have a perspective on that as the person who argued and lost the direct threat to self case in the Supreme Court. And
it was you?
It was me. Okay, it was terrible lawyering. I mean, I don't know what happened. But what the Supreme Court said, I mean, first of all, the Supreme Court was 9-0, which just shocked me. I mean, I was, when, first of all, I thought the argument went really well. And so, even though we lost, and then nobody, not one person. But what they said, what Justice Souter said in his opinion, I mean, the fact that it's 9-0 means it's going to be really hard to overturn in Congress, I think, because it's a common sense proposition to a lot of
Toyota.
People. Well, Toyota. But Toyota's a little different. I mean, you know, it's a common sense proposition to a lot of people that an employer shouldn't be required to put an employee in harm's way just because the employee chooses. You know, that there's a degree of anti-paternalism that we don't have yet in society. But what Justice Souter said was you have to really scientifically prove the risk. And in fact, we went back down on remand and we won on remand on the ground that there actually wasn't any risk to this guy. They just, you know, they had this unqualified company doctor who said, oh, well, you have a liver condition. Obviously, you can't work in an oil refinery, even though he'd been working there for 20 years. And I think, you know, the effort has to be to emphasize the kind of scientific, careful, objective, whatever you want to say, limitation on the direct threat defense.
Well, I think, you know, the fact that the EEOC said direct threat to self when justice didn't. I know, but it is. It's the EEOC's fault. And I naively, when I was working there as an attorney advisor in the mid-90s with Andy Imparato, I was under some impression it was like a mistake, that it was just a mistake that was made and somehow we could correct it. And then I found out, no, it really was an Evan Kemp, Chris Bell issue where they really thought that somehow, I don't know, people would receive the regs better or something. I don't know. I don't know what their rationale was. But I do know that it's you know, it's problematic because of the paternalistic. You know, I've heard people who you just wouldn't even imagine say something about it, say, you know, oh, my God, what if the person falls into machinery? Well, let's screen everybody that potentially could stumble or have a heart attack at work and say that, you know, they could fall into machinery too. So I'm worried about it, and I've been worried about it for a long time. We just haven't got there yet. Well, I'm hoping Gina prevents, you know, problems with that. The Gina regulations will be, they're out for comment right now, so people should take a look at those. We're really hoping that Gina prevents the discrimination in employment. Is that what you meant, or are you meant with the... Well, I think where we're going to see activity, if we see activity around Gina, is going to be with people with disabilities. It's going to be people that are asking for accommodations. It's going to be people that are asking, you know, disclosing something in the workplace. And so I think that, you know, there is going to be that connection. That's what I think.
I guess I got a chance. My name's Mark Sharmatz. I'm with the National Association of the Deaf. I'm a lawyer. I understand the Buchanan and problems. I want to get paid just like everybody else. But I think that we're missing something. The remedy. The true victims of discrimination are individuals with disabilities. They get no compensatory damages under Title III. They get no punitive damages for federal recipients. And they have a cap in employment that's 20 years old. The people who have been the victims of discrimination, not the lawyers, but the plaintiffs, should be compensated for their harm, and they're not being compensated.
I agree,
I would put that one on the top of the
list,
but
if they don't get
their
case taken, but if they don't get the case, you know.
If you don't have a remedy, why is somebody going to go through a Title III claim, go through discovery, be deposed, answer interrogatories, be subject, if they lost, to possible costs, and get all that happen to them if they're going to get zero?
Yeah. I mean, the thing about Title III,
the change.
Yeah, I mean, it's good. It would be. I've written that what should happen is there should be a damages remedy under Title III. I'm all for it. I mean, which didn't happen because of a compromise originally. But you know, there is something to the idea that what's going on in the Title III cases is about much more than one person, right? I mean, that's a random person. There are 100 people who don't go in, who don't try to do it.
Defendants will settle cases if they know they have. I agree. And the victims of discrimination are not getting anything.
I know, but what we saw, what we really just saw under what happened when they narrowed the definition and it was affecting employment, was that your plaintiff's employment attorneys weren't taking any of these cases. And that's what happens with with getting rid of the catalyst theory, is that you don't get people to take the cases, and that's a huge problem, right? If you can't make a living, you're not gonna do it, and so nobody gets a remedy, and that to me is worse.
We got to get you, Mike. This will be the last question.
Avoiding resolution for public broadly. It cuts both ways. I mean, we've seen bad settlements and bad plaintiffs also.
Yeah.